All right, so I'm sitting here now. I'm having a pint of Guinness, basically. you're having a fag.
Yeah, don't say it. It's bad for the voice.
I know. Oh, God almighty. I know. I quit smoking about 4 years ago. Have you always been a smoker?
I smoke. I've always smoked a bit, but I'm not proud of it. But I don't smoke a lot of cigarettes. I try to keep it, you know, fairly limited. But also then I gave up drinking about 17 years ago. And sometimes when you're gigging and you're drinking water for the whole time, and like, it's not really anything other than a sort of like, you know, post-gig, a thing that is like, okay, whew, now, okay, going to have a cigarette or something. So it's kind of in that mode. Or at the end.
Yeah, I mean, some people will have a joint, or some people will have a glass of wine, or some people, I don't know, will go for a run.
The energy that is, and I mean, this is interesting because it is one of the challenges that really has emerged out of COVID is what to do in terms of the energy of gigs. And, you know, I'm really passionate about gigging. I'm really passionate about the live performance and about what that means and about the transaction of energy between an audience and a band and the communication and the sense of, you know, dynamics. And, you know, so all of that also then has its adrenaline, obviously, you know, you're adrenalized before you go on stage and you're adrenalized off stage. Sometimes good. I mean, most of the time, hopefully good energy, and sometimes difficult energy, and managing that can be a challenge. And, you know, it's without doubt, I think for musicians, it presents problems because what do you do with that energy? So, you know, I'm afraid like that an occasional cigarette, you know, is, or a few cigarettes will be smoked by me. That's my okay, gig over time. And then wind down. It used to be the case sometimes going to late night gigs, you know, and I'm sure you know this yourself because like it's gig late, maybe, I don't know, like you'd be doing something and starting a gig at 12 o'clock and finishing at maybe around 2:30, you'd be getting out and doing breakdown. By the time you get home at 4 o'clock, you're there at 7 o'clock in the morning thinking, what in the name of Jesus am I doing, you know? So it's just gigs are what they are. So, you know, we used to, at an earlier stage in my career, we gigged so much. We gigged over 300 gigs a year at one point, you know, and it was for quite an extended period of time. And, you know, it was interesting.
Yes.
You just were rolling with it, okay? You're rolling, and you're so really pulling the energy from wherever you can. But it was funny I was part of the band that did support to BB King in the stadium, and they were talking about gigging, and they gigged 300 nights a year. And I remember we kind of thought about that. We would do about that. We'd do about 320, I think we were saying, kind of. And they were saying, oh man, that's more than you. But that's the blues.
Yeah. Well, you go on the road. That's what you do. You go on the road, and that's the life you live. And a lot of people kind of say, well, you have to lead a selfish life. But I think for some, you know, like some people don't get married or don't have children, and they don't bring those responsibilities into their life so they can actually lead that life, which I think is fair enough. I spent a huge amount of time on the road throughout my 20s into my early 30s.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I think that the period of time that we do that, there's a lot of life choices that go on in that. Now, part of the challenge is being kind of self-aware, you know, and for an awful lot of us as individuals, as people, never mind musicians, but as people trying to be self-aware and say, I'm actually making a choice here is a challenge. And then to look and to reflect on the choices you've made and not to sit back with regret with your choices is quite, you know, it can be challenging. And I think that sometimes it's, you know, it is the way things are. You've like, because I would say I was rolling with a whole bunch of things over the earlier part of my gigging and career. I would have started from, like, I started singing when I was I don't know, I was on someone's knee when I started singing. I have a very, just out of amusement, my first memory of singing a song, I was sitting on a nun's knee singing, "These boots are made for walking."
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know how the nun felt about it, but I had been taught the lyrics by the older members of my family, obviously. And so I was there proudly saying, "These boots are made for walking. They're going to walk all over you." The nun kind of was a bit nonplussed, I suppose. She just didn't really know what to do with it. But let me carry on anyway. So I always sang, and I always sang in choirs, and I always I would have been in five choirs at one stage. I did vocal training and sang all the time through school. But for example, like, I would have gone as far as grade six in singing, and then I felt like I genuinely felt that the training was shifting my voice, because it was moving into an operatic kind of end of things, because yeah. I really had to at that level of training. So I stepped away from that, but I was just starting to do a bit of gigging at the time as well, and felt like, okay, I'm actually making that choice. But the road work then is something that is an interesting one as well, because, you know, it you can't not do it if it's on offer. You know, you, like, in a way, as a working musician, certainly when I would have started in the, like, late 80s and 90s, it was a way of making money and yeah. a way of earning your living. And it was on the back of that if you had product, then you sold product from your gigs. And we always did sell tremendous amount of stuff to people who wanted to go away with something from a gig. But,
yeah.
you know, kind of stepping back from it was very difficult. And I did decide to do that at a later stage. But the gigs, I like, you know, genuinely, like, there is nothing in the world as really exciting and fulfilling as a good gig and a good response. You know that yourself.
Absolutely. Do you mind me asking, like, when did you step back and why did you step back? I mean, was that a difficult decision to make?
It was sort of, what I would say is that it was, things ebb and flow in your life, I suppose, in loads of ways. So yeah. momentum, that maybe is a load of road work, and that's fine. That carries on for as long as it does. There was a change. There were different stages where things changed. And so, for example, the introduction of, I mean, I'm old enough to be saying things like the introduction of, for example, you know, DJing or karaoke machines or all of those things, which shifted some part of the potential to, like, I've always looked after a good deal of the management, let's say, aspects of the band. I'm extremely fortunate that I have Brian as my partner, because Brian is so good on publicity and music work and thinking. So we work as partners, but we both have different kind of responsibilities. So I would often be like the one maybe who'd ring up the gigs and book the gigs. And that kind of changed, you know, because basically because to pay a five-piece band was costing more than a lot of venues really were interested in spending. Because yeah. have to factor in things like, you know, travel, where we were staying, if we were staying, what, you know, all of those elements changed. There were other difficulties. I'm going to say, be honest and say there were other difficulties where, you know, there was a move away from, we'll say, independent bands or bands doing their stuff themselves. So that, you know, and a sort of corporatizing of music to some extent.
Yeah.
That you had to be under a particular roof to have access to a number of gigs. And, you know, there's implications from that, because, you know, if you're under a particular roof, which would be a big production company who are doing a whole bunch of bands, putting them out on the road, you know, that's what it is. That's a very good thing in many ways. And that's how a lot of people work. And what yeah. I expected is also, it diminished some of the independence that we were able to have. which was basically to say, where are the gigs? Let's look out for the good ones. Let's look out for what's happening. Where are people getting good response from? Let's see if we can ring up the individual who's looking after that gig, and let's make a plan. And the plan is, okay, do you have a date? Yeah, if you have a date, and we work out the details. So moving, managing that side of things, and then gigging, and then being on the road, things ebb and flow. So there was a movement, let's say, or a diminishing of what was possible. So ringing up places became less possible at a particular stage. So now I'd be talking, as we approach, say, you know, mid-90s into late-90s, things changed somewhat. All of the time we would have been doing other pieces. We would have been, what was unusual, I suppose, in our career, and I say our because it's really important for me to acknowledge that, you know, for example, Brian would have had a real drive to record, and a lot of gigging bands don't record.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're on the road, and they kind of, and they're doing a kind of different thing. So that would have been part of the work that we did as well. And then I would be, I suppose, honest and say that I was feeling a lot of pressure in the mid-90s, late-90s, really. And the pressure was manifold. It was because I'd been on the road a lot, but also because I certainly was feeling that there were challenges to what I was trying to do. I'm a believer in collectives. A band in itself is a collective.
Yeah,
musicians together are collectives. In my other work that I do in education, I believe that there's real value in seeing how people can cooperate and communicate and work together and be separate and individual and yet connected. And so I tried to work with a number of different projects that were kind of collective, you know, collectively based. In the kind of later 90s, and found, to be honest, that it didn't work, to put a fine point on it, that it became other than what I would have thought was there's a group of musicians or a group of different bands, in fact, all coming together to try and achieve something together. But, you know, it has often been the case. I think that there's all sorts of federations of musicians or, you know, the Association of Irish Musicians. There are organizations that try to bring people together. And it is a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge for loads of different reasons. So that was wearing. And it was around that time then that I would have been feeling, for example, that in my kind of frustration or anger or distress or whatever you want to call it, I would have certainly been drinking too much. And, you know, like earlier in my career, I was basically bring it on. I'm as good as any of the blokes and I'm going to drink as much as any of them together. And then, you know, and this, I've never made much of an issue of this. These are just choices and decisions. And then you have to look at it and say, is this what I want to be doing, how I want to be? So pulling back was kind of a combination of elements that came together, not least because of the pressure of being on the road and then the challenge of breaking through to not be just that person who is on the road forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, you know, and to try and rethink things a little bit differently. So, you know, there was a number of things, Johnny. I mean, they're kind of circumstantial and there's a lot of hard decisions or unpleasant bits to that. But ultimately, I suppose I would feel that I have to be responsible for myself. So then, would have been around that time, around the early 2000s, that we kind of shifted gear somewhat and then have come kind of forwards and backwards somewhat along the way as well. So we keep on, you know, re-engaging, let's say, and I keep on re-engaging. And I have to say, through all of those years being on the road, the opportunities and the experiences will never be repeated. I mean, the people that we met were, and the people that I got to know, you know, I'm thinking through earlier on before we were talking, you know, the fact that I could actually meet John Lee Hooker and, you know, sit in a room talking with John Lee Hooker because we played support with him in the stadium in Dublin. And like, it was kind of funny because I was looking it up recently. It was around 89, and we had just started the band. Really, we weren't. So Johnny Hooker was coming to the stadium, and we got the gig to do support. So that night, I remember, because I grew up hearing Johnny Hooker again when I was a little kid, because blues was in the house. But I remember hearing him and. We didn't get to meet him that night. And I was kind of disappointed, the way you'd be, you know, you're kind of thinking, you know, this is going to be great. Like, but we did go out in Dublin with his band. So we went out, there was a bass player, there was a sax player, there was a bunch of heads after his gig, John Lee Hooker's gig. So he was relatively elderly. He went back to the hotel, whatever, and we went out. So that's around 5 months later, 6 months later or something. We're in the States, and we noticed that John Lee was playing in a great club called Toad's Place. Will we go, says we. So we went along, and I have to say, here's where, you know, you have to watch your arrogance. It was actually the first time for a long time that I paid into a gig, because and I was like, yeah, okay, no, it's definitely worth it. So anyway, in we go, and we got the stamp on the hand. And we were just waiting. Buckwheat Zydeco played support. And then I was sitting, and the Toad's Place has a sort of, you walk in, it's on the ground floor, and then the dressing room is down a stairs in a basement-y kind of area. So I see coming up the stairs the guy, Jim, who is a bass player. And I said to Brian, I was like, there, Jim, that's, and I went over to him and I said, Jim, yeah, how's it going? Mary from Dublin. And he was like, oh, wow, yeah, great. And he said to me, do you want to come down and meet Mr. Hooker? And I'm standing there thinking, like, oh, my God, yeah, I want. Like, and just to actually find yourself, and this is where the beauty of music is, that actually you have a community of people who are, that you have these opportunities because you're connected because of the language of music, regardless of any other upbringing, backstories, anything like that. Nothing else matters. You've connected because of music. So, you know, meeting Fats Domino was another extraordinary situation. And again, it was because we were playing support.
Yeah,
we were in a very fortunate stage. At a particular point, there was a huge amount of blues artists coming to perform in Dublin. You know, it was a remarkable kind of phase. And, you know, I don't know if it can ever happen in that way again. But like someone like Fats Domino as a global influence across the board in music, in rock and roll, in everything. So when he was playing, like, the amazing thing was, like, he himself had this extraordinary, huge band, right? So for example, you know, with Zepp, where you have the three drummers, right?
Yeah.
Zepp. And that's such an amazing thing to hear. First time I saw anyone bringing three drummers on the road, actually, was, again, I don't know, early 90s, can't remember the year, but it was Fats Domino had 11 brass players. He had three drummers, and then he had another. So he had an entourage with him of about, I don't know, 24 people or something.
Yeah.
He was bringing on the road. They played, I think, two gigs in Dublin and played a gig in Belfast, and we did all of those gigs, the support. So we kind of got to know them. And we got to know the band as, you know, and as you do. So incredible musicians like Lee Allen and all these brilliant New Orleans-based musicians, and then meeting Fats and seeing a couple of things, Johnny, if you bear with me, because Fats Domino is, he just, number one, he was always beaming. He was all smiling.
Yeah.
Smiling the whole time. And he was smiling at his audience and he was smiling. So then when we went, after the first gig, I think it was in the stadium, there was a lot at the time in Dublin, there was quite a, and there always has been, you know, a big rockabilly scene. So there was quite a few people who were really going all out in their rockabilly gear and women looking brilliantly and blokes looking great and the drape coats and the whole bit. And he was staying in the Burlington. So we went there because we knew that they were staying there. And people were going for like an after gig drink. You know, you go somewhere after the gig and it was the stadium. So the gig wasn't the late gig. Anyway, here we go. And his band were kind of around the place and we were talking with various members of band because, you know, and getting to know them. But then we were in a room or in one of the rooms in the Burlington and there was a grand piano with a cover over it, which was used for whatever, you know, lounge lizard kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I presume. But anyway, you know, the kind of coach comes up, pulls up and Fats kind of walked in and he kind of looked around the room and Brian was near the piano. So Brian is my husband and my partner. And like so Brian was just near the piano as Fats kind of was walking past or it. So Brian threw the cover off, picked up the cover and threw it off the piano, just displaying the fact that there was a piano there. And, you know, Fats kind of looked around and there was several rockabillies and there was a small enough group of people. He looked around and he sat down and he said, I'll do a song or two. And away he went. So as he started playing Blueberry Hill or whatever it was.
That was his big song, Blueberry Hill. My dad used to play that on the piano.
Yeah, a brilliant song. And there's so many of them. Ain't That a Shame? But like everyone in the room started singing along and Fats looked up, genuinely moved. And he looked around the crowd and he said, I've sung these songs for 50 years. I've never had them sung back to me like this. And it was just one of those moments that you kind of, you know, it's the lump of the throat moment of this is what it's about.
Yeah. And you were there and there was probably, how many people were there? 20 people?
20 people, 30 people at the most. Incredible. And you know, another thing that I thought, and again, you see, I think about, because again, I'm blues, like there's it's a music that has history but has currency, if you know what I mean. That always means something to someone somewhere because it's an expression of something which is it is raw and kind of emotional. And at the same time, it's based on communication of some level of either pain or joy, may I say, or just have a good time. But someone like Fats Domino, someone in the band was describing how and why there are so many people in the entourage. He didn't need to have three drummers. He would have one drummer play for the first 30 minutes, second drummer would come up on the third drummer. And it was really quite interesting. Like, what's going on? Why is that about? The discussion came about that Fats was aware that in New Orleans in particular, there was a particularly difficult problem with drug issues and particularly with heroin addiction and, you know, crack and a whole bunch of things that were happening at the time. And his philosophy was, I actually heard him saying this, if I bring these people, these musicians on the road, there's a possibility that we'll save them from another choice, which again, you just think like that's what someone who is a leader does.
Yeah.
But someone who's looking after people and believing in their truth, in their, you know, and seeing, people are vulnerable. We're all, you know, so vulnerable, but you give someone a lift or reach out a hand in music. And that can be just singing a song for someone, or that can be you drumming, it can be a solo or anything. It's just that piece of humanity that is.
Yeah, and a sense of purpose, I think, as well, is very important. And I think right now for musicians who aren't doing a hell of a lot, you know, having a sense of purpose is more important now than it's ever been.
Completely agree. And I think that it is really challenging to have a sense of purpose because, again, you know, your purpose as a musician is to play music, which certainly you can do in a room. And yet at the same time, it is to perform, it's to share the music is what I should say. And, you know, it's funny because even in that, and I've been thinking, we've been thinking hard about this and wondering about, like, you know, and I really do see such value in things like, you know, people doing podcasts, doing a broadcast, or, you know, playing on Facebook pieces or whatever it is. But it's difficult. I also think I was talking about this just yesterday. I was thinking, like, there's actually, you know, the physical change. The idea of playing, I think the difficulty of playing a socially distanced gig is that it seems like the complete opposite of what a gig is supposed to be doing.
It's funny because the people I've been speaking to over the last few months are, you know, their interpretations or their experiences have been very different. As you know, certain songwriters are they don't really want to put out any music now because they kind of want to wait so they can tour it and, you know, and monetize it to some degree. Whereas, you know, people like Cullen McInumra, who lives, you know, great violinist, lives in rural Wexford. And he said, well, life didn't change that much for him because he lives, you know, in a very quiet place. So for him, it's been a huge opportunity to be creative and actually kind of go, okay, I do have more time now because he's not touring and stuff like that. So he's making music, whereas other people are reluctant to put it out. You're a gigger, Mary. I'm a gigger, you know.
Yeah, and I'm a gigger. And I mean, you know, and I, at the same time, like we've been really, the other side is, I suppose that, you know, I would also, like I have dual career. Like basically I work in education and I'm very committed to that as well. But it's all about guidance and kind of nurturing, trying to nurture people or trying to nurture their sense of self and working with people in that kind of context. But so, and then Brian is an artist and he's been able to make art. But again, we have been able, you know, not when it's full lockdown, it's really challenging, but we've been able to pursue projects that are recording projects that really gigging, you know, it can be hard to actually put the time aside. And I mean, I do think it's hard to make it work. And I really respect the fact that people feel if I put myself out there for nothing, what am I worth? I think that's a valid question.
Yeah.
It's difficult to answer that, you know, for two people, because I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what a future, you know, can be. And I think it's a very challenging, it really is challenging because we're giggers.
Yeah, well, I think you can't lose your sense of worth either. You know, for me, I've enjoyed the break. I've enjoyed the calmness of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I, you know, I'm like yourself, Mary. I've gigged for 32 years, like a lot.
Yeah.
And the kind of slowing down, because I'm 46 now.
Yeah.
And just to have that little bit of time to reflect and actually go, okay, well, maybe I don't have to do these certain elements of my life that I wasn't particularly enjoying that were, you know, just affecting me and my positivity. So I can maybe get rid of that and I can work a little bit less and earn a little bit less, but not have to worry about it, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I'm also, I've got a lot of friends. I mean, most of my friends are musicians and mm-hmm. there's a lot of people struggling. And when you're hearing the stories of their hardship and, you know, it's funny because all we want to do is just keep the house warm, put food in the fridge and pay our bills.
Yeah.
That's it. And yeah. And now you have people being forced into, I'm not saying poverty, mm-hmm. but forced into a very, very compromising situation where, yeah. you know, you're accentuating their worry you know, and their ability to, you know, the inability to function as a normal family, or, you know. I mean, a lot of marriages have been put to the test, I'll tell you that much.
And I think that the sense of self-worth is such a precious kind of, you know, it's such a precious part of our being to have some sense of belief and sense of purpose. I'm really glad that you would use that word, because actually that is, you know, one of the things that I've always felt about anything I'm doing. I mean, really across the board, is that I actually like being kind of useful, or, you know, having a sense, well, I'm doing this because of that, and this is what I'm hoping to get out as an outcome. And to kind of think that, for example, it is similar to making art, making music, to think that you can kind of turn it on, turn it off in like a tap, that it doesn't actually, you know, that there isn't something, like I was talking earlier on about the energy of gigs, even in terms of recognizing, we should, for example, like out of the gigs that we have continued gigging on to a lesser extent. So last weekend we should have been down in Cork doing 5 back-to-back gigs, which basically would have been, you know, starting gigging at 4 p.m. and finishing at 1 a.m. You know, yeah. Like, and basically we would have been kind of just, I personally, what my habit of the last years has been that we stay near to where the gig is, and I would get up, get ready for a gig, go do a gig, go back to the hotel, sit for an hour, maybe eat something, then go back to the stage, do a gig, and back and forth and back and forth. So the strangeness of having something that is, and again, we've been over 20 years doing that, you know, in one various with a different individual musicians all along the years. The weirdness of having a kind of sense of energy at this time of the year, coming up to Halloween, you know, it's very strange, because usually this week we're bollocksed. We're just sitting there like flaked out, thinking like, I arrive at the point back, you know, day or two later where I can properly talk again. And, you know, because I'm using the voice in, you know, for whatever it is, amount of hours, and it's full tilt. Mm. So it's even that is like a very unsettling, you know, and I'm lucky. I'm really lucky, because I know that I have other facilities or other a sense of purpose out of my other place that is me, you know. And again, you know, to step back and to believe that what you do is valuable when you're not getting the kind of response that gigging gives you is a very hard place to be. And that's why we all have to be gentle and careful of each other, you know, and understanding, you know, if someone's kind of, we try and be communicative and be as, you know, positive as possible, and see things as being, you know, this is now, but it's not forever.
Yeah, well, I think fingers crossed. I think everybody's hoping that, and I think everybody's quietly optimistic. I think it's the only way you can be right now.
It can't be any other way.
And you know, being an Irish person, that the winters in Ireland are pretty tough.
Yeah, and again, like the shift to, well, it's the grey, I think, that I find, you know, really challenging, but. You know, the kind of sense of it's dark, you know, and looking out the window and now and saying, yeah, there we go. But it's funny, Johnny, and maybe this is a product of age, and I won't say my age, but I will say I'm older than you. But I will say that one of the things that is useful, I think, is to remember that one way or the other, everything changes. So in other words, it is the case, I had to kind of pause on a certain type of expression through music for myself.
Yeah.
I was going to self-destruct, I would suggest. There was a point where I certainly came very close to, you know, gaskets blown and it's retrievable kind of situation. And that was through the challenge of performing, the challenge and the demand of being a performer, the challenge and demand of the drive to the next thing. What is the next thing that you have to do? The next thing, the next thing. So the reality is that even if one has to manage for a period of time in a different place, that things will come around again. And I can say that with confidence, nothing will ever be the same.
Yeah.
Things can come back to a place where you still have, people will always need music. People will always need performances and performers, and they'll always need that opportunity. I believe in audiences, and I believe in humanity in that kind of way. Blues artists are also useful to kind of reflect on in that. And again, you know, it's interesting to see how, for example, another artist that I was very fortunate to get to know is Taj Mahal. And Taj is still playing and still working and is celebrating, I think he celebrated his 78th birthday or something. And one of the things about all of the, well, most who's in history, historical terms, part of what blues was about actually was that it was people who worked or did stuff, whatever it happened to be, and they went out and played music as well. So in other words, they were shaking off part of the, let's say, the perhaps mundane or the drudgery, perhaps, if they were working. And a lot of heads, like just Coco Taylor is one of the most brilliant blues women and most brilliant blues singers that you can imagine. She worked as a cleaning lady. I mean, pretty much all her, like for an awful lot of her life, she worked as a cleaning woman. So what she was doing and expressing when she went out to perform was her release from that situation. So, you know, it sometimes may feel that the dices are so loaded against us now, as all musicians now, that the dices are heavily loaded and it's, what am I going to do? And it's never going to come back. And it's, you know, so it is important sometimes to remember that through history, people have prevailed and musicians have prevailed and they've shifted gear and we're all adaptable, I think. We have so much that we can do, Johnny.
Absolutely. I think if Keith Richards and Marianne Faithfull are still alive, there's hope for us all.
Yeah. And I have to say, I concur. And we won't. And again, like, you know, who was that? I was looking through some women artists there recently, but there was a woman called Viola Smith, a drummer. I don't know if you know her, probably. But Viola Smith, she passed away, I think, last week.
Yes, she was an innovator, but like way back when.
And she was 103.
Yeah.
And she had, apparently, as her motto was that, and like she said, drinking wine and playing the drums were what keeps her alive, kind of thing. She said that, I think, when she hit 100 or something like that. Jolly Hooker was quite a significant age. B.B. King was of a significant age. Like, yeah, but may I say that they did not always have... So in other words, maybe what I'm trying to talk about or trying to suggest is that there's the up wave and the down wave.
Mm.
You know, there's the kind of build to like a level of, we'll say, you know, popularity or success, whatever that is, and independence and being able to put the food on the table. But there can be then a down wave, but there's the learning part of that that actually will feed the next up wave.
My father always said to me, he says, you're going into the music industry. He said, you know, I'm just going to let you know, son, that there's only highs and there's only lows. There's very little in between. You know? And I understand what he means.
Absolutely. And again, was your dad in the music industry?
My old man played guitar and piano and sang. Yeah. And he was a bit of a raconteur and a bit of a, how would you say, just a character, really. And he just enjoyed company and he enjoyed music. And I grew up around that, you know. I grew up around very much song-based music, you know. And that's the kind of, as a drummer, that's really what I'm into. And it's funny because having been in my own blues band, The Creators, which we formed a few years ago, still waiting on a record to come out. But, you know, you mentioned earlier the rawness. There's a rawness to it, and there's a kind of honesty to blues music that I really, really loved, because lyrically as well, as you can really relate to what the songs are about. You can really relate to the sentiment. Mm-hmm. You know, I do listen to a lot of 50s music, more 50s rock and roll and doo-wop and things like that. But what I love about that music is it's a bunch of people playing in a room. There's no tracks or overdubs or, you know.
And, you know, I totally agree, because, I mean, therein lies one of the challenges of recording. And, you know, we've been really lucky now. And, again, I have to say, working with Sarah Michelle on the guitar has, and just in terms of the 50s doo-wop, is an interesting one, because last Christmas we released a song which was, Sarah rearranged. We brought a song that Brian had wanted to work on, which was from Bessie Smith, which was At the Christmas Ball. And Bessie Smith was recorded in like 1925 or something. Mm. So it's a strange little song, because it wasn't a straight blues, nor was it. It was a strange arrangement. Anyway, Sarah took it, and between jigs and reels, the point I'm making is that actually myself and Sarah, and I have to say, encouraged very much by Brian's love of that doo-wop and the kind of, you know, that kind of vocal harmony, female vocal harmony groups, you know, that you would remember, like the Andrews Sisters and all this kind of thing. So myself and Sarah started working on layering vocals, but doing it kind of as much as we could together, like, in other words, so that, again, you have that kind of, like, you separate instruments recording blues, you have a huge challenge. You just don't have a vibe, you know. It's just as simple as that. That you kind of end up in a situation where you have something that actually sounds really good but very clean. So our first album, actually, we recorded the first album we did was, we released in 97, God bless the mark, but that was a compilation of recordings we'd done over a period of years. Then we put out an album which was recorded live in Brussels. We had this, like, you know, I don't know, we had a regular gig in Brussels Sunday afternoon, which was sort of, it was one of these gigs that just everything that could happen did happen and would happen. And people came in and guested with us. It was completely loose and completely legendary in some respects. It went for 15 years. But we got the studio, we brought the recording studio to the gig in order to record a second album, because we were so confounded by the fact that, how do you get the sound sounding live? How do you get that feeling? And, you know, like, again, now we can't be doing this during COVID, but again, a lot of the time with any of the blues stuff, it was a microphone set up in the middle of a room.
Yeah.
Chess records are the hallmark of the Chicago blues sound. And the recording artists were all of the Helen Muff and Muddy Waters and Little Walter. And they basically worked on the principle of get it down as fast as possible, as quickly as you can. And then, you know, there was no sophistication really in the music. So it had to be brilliant on the spot. It had to be what it was. And it's very hard to capture in a room. But that tradition as well that you talk about, the kind of, you know, the singing and the, you know, the like the song singing thing. My mother played piano, and, for example, was a really good piano player, and my father sang, but they used to, when they were younger, and this is like, we're going back to the 40s, like 50s, when they were younger, there would be do's, as they'd say, there'd be a do, and the do, and my mother would be the piano player, and she'd say, like, and she'd look like she was a teetotaler and very, but loved playing music, But she'd look at certain people and think, oh, you know, what key are they in? And she'd be able to, by ear, she'd be figuring out what key they are in rather than them knowing themselves.
Yeah.
All that. And it's about people kind of communicating. So blues as well, you know, I sang everything kind of in a way sometime. At one point I've sung pretty much. And one of the things with classical music was, in fact, when I was doing training, you know, I had limited. I'll put it to you this way. I always got placed in competitions. I'd always be in second place or third place. The only competition I ever won in the FESH was the Manaw competition because I was singing in Irish. And every other song I was singing, like German Leader or, you know, whatever it happened to be, I couldn't connect with the lyrics, obviously. I mean, I knew, I studied German, I knew what I was singing, but I just couldn't, you know, there'd be one like about a trout in a stream and I'm like, yeah, well, whatever, I don't want to sing this. But I did win a competition, the Manaw competition, and I won it because of like my expression. In the middle of it, I had actually forgotten the words. So I was there kind of jamming away, like trying to get...
If you don't know them, make them up.
Yeah, make them up, and I would kind of blah, 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 whatever, you know, keep going. But I suppose, you know, and then I sang jazz for a good while, or, you know, a couple of years when I was younger. And I love Ella Fitzgerald, and I love, obviously, Billie Holiday crosses over between a blues jazz thing, but I love Frank Sinatra and so many jazz vocalists. I mean, I really, but the lyrics would be wrecking my head. I'd be like, really, I couldn't. And I remember then doing another thing where I did some of the Portuguese, you know, the Girl from Ipanema, all that kind of.
Yeah.
And like, if it was in Portuguese, it was fine. Like I'd be able to sing that. But there was a thing about lyrics, and that's where I found myself back to blues. And it was back to blues because a singer has to deliver words. It means something.
Yeah.
Singing, you're saying something. And in everything that I would be singing, I'm really conscious, you know, because I have to deliver the words. I have to make the words resonate, or I have to understand if I'm trying to blast out a message, or am I trying to lullaby a baby? You know, what is it that I'm trying to do? And the words are part of that. So performing is caught up in a lot of things like that. And again, that comes back like to being a woman on you know, and doing. Deliberately taking, for example, songs that are from, like you look at the heads I'm talking about, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, all of those Chess blues heads, they a lot of men, and they were delivering a truth for themselves. Yeah. But it wasn't about... Kind of, I'm not interested in my man done left me and I feel miserable and I'm just going to sit here being miserable. I'm interested in being defiant. When trouble comes, you look at it and you try and meet it eye to eye and you think, where is my strength? And you deliver on that. And in music, that's where I'm coming from. Or if I'm singing about something that's sad, or that is political, you know, or if there's something that's going on. We wrote a song called Blues for New Orleans, and we have it recorded. Fortunately, we recorded it just recently. Robbie and Barrett played drums, and again, he brought something really nice to it again, which is, you know, like there's a whole bunch of things, Chris playing bass and then Sarah on guitar and Brian on harp. And like... We wrote the song around the time of the flood in New Orleans because it was just so unbelievable to think that it's not now as unbelievable perhaps as it was at the time. The year was maybe, I don't know, it's a long time ago now really. But at the time to see the richest country in the world and see people like actually just dying in water. Because someone didn't manage the levees. So it's political. So there's things that are lament, that are tragic, that are political, or that are defiant and joyous and have a good time. And don't forget, by the way, this is what life is about. That's where lyrics and the music of blues come together for me, would be in all of that space.
Yeah. Well, like I was saying earlier, there's such an honesty to all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with blues music as well, or lyrically as well, it's quite easy to follow and easy to understand for the average listener, you know?
Sure.
But it's very heartfelt and it's very honest. And it seems to be something that's very easy to connect with, you know, the depth of it.
Yeah.
You know, I've always listened to blues music, but I grew up listening to a lot of rock and roll as well, 50s rock and roll, a lot of Chuck Berry. Little Richard, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis. Did you ever come across Jerry Lee Lewis because he lived in Ireland for a long time?
Yeah, he did. And you know what the casting is? I didn't. And again, our paths, it was like, you know, the way they have that, you know, where there's just, you know, the arcs just don't actually cross. One of the that I played with, who played with us, I should say, in Ireland, was Becky Brindle years ago. And she was a brilliant guitar player, is a brilliant guitar player. She's back in the States. She lived in Ireland for a year. So she worked with Jerry Lee at some point. And again, it didn't happen. And I have to say, Jerry Lee would be a huge influence, because he was a huge influence on my brother Dermot, who plays piano with me. So Dermot plays piano. When I was growing up, again, when I was a small thing, Dermot would have been blasting away. And he had one of the, you know, he had a very really good blues band with Ed Dean, who was still playing away. And Dermot and Ed had a band called Blues House. But Jerry Lee and the whole thing of the foot up on the piano and the whole urgency and the almost like, you know, the whole, all of those stories, for example, and the thing about Jerry Lee lighting the piano on fire, and you know, recently when Little Richard passed, you know, there were so many brilliant things to watch of his footage of Little Richard being interviewed, and he was just extraordinary. And then you have other, like, there's so many. I mean, again, all of that crossover between kind of, we'll say, jazz, blues, rock and roll, swing, all of that music, all of it is connected and is pretty much the same thing. Chuck Berry, huge influence. And now we got to meet briefly Chuck Berry, but we didn't have a chance really to get to know him, because he was too busy getting paid and legging it out there. But for example, we did get to meet Bo Diddley, and like, huge influence on me. Like Bo Diddley, he must be, you know, Bo Diddley beat, like.
Yeah, which that rhythm, I mean, that's from the clave African rhythm, which is down, 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 you know. I mean, I love all that, you know.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's gas, because you look at the influence there and you kind of bring things like U2 Desire, you know.
Exactly. That calls the same rhythm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hear it all the time. And I mean, again, you know, Bo was gassed, because again, it was just over a period of time. We were in that kind of situation where it happened. Now, this would have been, I don't know, later 90s, and the band I was working with, we were focusing actually on a more rock and roll at the time, a more rock and roll approach. So I actually would have been kind of bringing in stuff that was sort of rockabilly tinged, which again would be something that I really enjoy, is blues. Like that Chuck Berry feel, like, no, you know, like you just have to just hear some of the opening kind of he needs
incredible
any more than it's, you know, it's Johnny B. Goode and it goes like this, you know, and it's like, so like the crossover, Bo Diddley played in Dublin, and we did support. There was a really nice kind of story, just for the laugh. He was playing in the new Mean Fiddler when it opened, if you remember that.
Wexford Street,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was all done up. Anyway, yeah, and we'd already played, but he was playing there. It was a great gig, and there were lovely kind of arrangement and all the rest. But so we kind of, we very carefully knocked on the door just to see if we could say hello to him, you know, and I ended up again having a chat. He was having a bit of grub. But it turned out we at the time had his, we had just recorded a song of his, Dearest Darling, and we were about to record it, but we play it all the time. It's one of my things, Dearest Darling. It's a love song, and it's just fun. But so we went in and asked his permission to perform and to maybe record Dearest Darling, and his comment was, as long as I get my $10. So we just, anytime we, you know, it's like, and that was his concern. And he was basically saying, what is the disappointment? What can be the disappointment for people is where they feel that they've created something and they don't get ownership of it. So there we go back full circle to the sort of, what do I do now to keep an income, to manage an income and to have ownership of it, you know? So he was still, he was trying to figure that one out whenever, Bo Diddley and I introduced, my other gas story was where I introduced Taj Mahal to Booker T. Jones, which was one of the bizarre situations I ever found myself in. The reason being, we were over in England, it was a festival, Bishopstock. We played a lot. We played a lot in Europe, like over the years. We played in the Milkweg in Amsterdam. We toured all Holland. We did all through. Yeah, the Milkweg is brilliant. All through Italy, we did a lot of stuff in Italy, a lot of stuff in Spain, a little bit of stuff in Germany, and a lot of stuff in the States. We played the House of Blues in the States and all sorts of great gigs. But there was a festival in England, Bishopstock, and we were on the lineup. We were on one set of stage, so there was Booker T and the MGs. Nina Simone was at it. Van Morrison himself was at it. Gary Moore played it, Booker T and the MGs, Taj Mahal, all this. Anyway, I knew the woman who was running it. We had met her through, again, music connections, Helen, and it was in the grounds of her castle. It was a castle, and it was actually on these huge grounds. And so, like, you'd be there thinking, it's a bit like Slane Castle. So, happened. I knew your woman enough for her to say, she came up to me at one point, and this was, I think it was before we were gigging. She came up and she said, because I had met Taj Mahal in Dublin and we got to know each other and spent a bit of time talking, working with, you know, and she said, you know, Taj, he's in the kitchen. I need someone to go in and look after him. Will you go? Go. So anyway, I must have gone into the kitchen in the castle. And at the time, drinking wine, sitting all afternoon chatting with Taj, and it was just incredible. He's talking about his background and his mother was born in, I think his mother was born in St. Kitts, so he always had that calypso feel, stuff that he does, and he's very experimental. In fact, he would have done, like you were talking about, the African thing. He did a huge amount of stuff, he brought a band to perform in Dublin, where they were really doing, you know, sort of coming from, it might have been Mali or was, you know, there was a whole African thing that he did. But anyway, Taj is sitting in the kitchen. I'm there talking, having a couple of glasses of wine, having a good time, thinking like, Jesus, like, you know. And Brian came into the kitchen at some point. That was cool. We were sitting there. But the night before we had met, there was a kind of party thing on. And at that we had met Steve Cropper,
and because
they were playing with Booker T. Jones,
so
Steve Cropper, can I just say that I have never in my life met anyone who was so much of a total gentleman. He was absolutely charming, but also really funny and nice. And then you think of the Steve Cropper sound, which obviously everyone who knows guitar will know. Incredible. Like Green Onions, we'll say, just as an example. So anyway, I'm in the kitchen with Taj, we're talking, and then the door opens and in comes Booker T and Steve Cropper, and I'm sitting there. So what happened was, I was kind of really presuming that they would know each other. Like, they're of an age and they're of it, you know. And I was thinking, I presumed, and then they were kind of looking at each other, and I said, like, I presume, like, you know each other, like Taj, Booker T.
Yeah.
Booker T, this is Taj. And I was like, really, you know, these moments where you're thinking, this is like something, this is not what I thought was going to happen today. So anyway, it turned out, and this is interesting for people in music as well. Here are two giants of music, of blues, but of music in general, of world music and everything. So Booker T and Taj Mahal, both of them remarked that they had never they knew each other, but because they were always on the road, they never actually met until today. And it was truly amazing, because then they were saying, Taj says to Booker T, he said, you know what, man? He said, I was rehearsing my first band, whenever that was, 60-something. I was rehearsing my first band when your single was out. And so Booker T had one of his singles. I don't think it was Green Onions. Brian knew the name of the song. But anyway, he said, you were playing across the road. I said to my band, we're going out of the rehearsal studio, we're going over to this gig, and we're checking this out, because this is the way it's supposed to be. So, I mean, again, you have that learning from each other and being in a way, allowing everyone to be different, but allowing everyone to be respected, because we really don't want cookie cutter music, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, my Steve Cropper, I mean, I was introduced to him, his music, his guitar playing from the Blues Brothers, yep. Which again, that kind of reinvigorated blues music back in the early 80s, you know?
Absolutely.
And, you know, through that movie and also through that band. I mean, those guys hired the best musicians ever.
Absolutely.
You know, and I did get to meet Steve Jordan, who was the drummer in that band at the time. And I love those live records, but that was how I kind of learned how to play blues, you know?
Yeah. And again, they were making the reference point, you know, it is really interesting that actually that, you know, that was through both Dan Aykroyd and Belushi both loved blues.
Yeah.
Themselves. And it's a bit...
All the Stax recordings, you know, Motown, everything. Yeah. They just, you know, and it's that thing of they modernized it, but they also brought it into my generation as a kid watching it, you know.
Which is brilliant, you know, because that's how things are supposed to be. That's exactly what I'm saying, Johnny, that like you're not, you know, there was also another kind of, an odd kind of undercurrent challenge that I would have felt is that, like, I don't know that there's much point, for example, in me trying to do something that sounds exactly like it was recorded in Chicago in 1940, whatever. Because I'm not there. I'm not, number one, I'm not a blues man from 1940. I don't have the same experience. I'm not coming at it. I mean, everything is entirely different. So it's a really important thing to me, that it isn't about being overly reverential, while one, like I suppose I'm saying, there's a distinction between being completely respectful, but then you don't have to be bowing down at the altar of something and saying, like, it can only be played this way, because that's why music keeps on going. That's because it keeps evolving, and it just comes out as being different, and that's the beauty of it as well.
Yeah, I find the older I get, the more I'm looking back at music. I'm delving deeper into all of those genres, you know, and instead of kind of, I'm not giving much of a shit what's going on right now, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I suppose I did grow up on a lot of that kind of music as well. And
sure.
I also love sometimes the imperfection of music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because everything is so polished now as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you listen to an old record, you can hear the blues man tapping his foot. You can hear the squeaky hi-hat stand of the musicians. And I think that's great, because you feel like you're in the room with them.
Absolutely. And again, that's you know, that is one of the biggest challenges we have. And we've like, and genuinely, because, you know, even with the most willing and enthusiastic kind of people, we were so lucky to work with such good people. I must say that I'm really happy to say, like, we have a set of different recording pieces that we have that we're kind of pulling together now, you know, that had happened, some very deliberately going in to record X songs, and some were kind of semi-accidental recordings, as in going into a studio. And again, I have to thank Brian for thinking of doing this, because his, you know, sometimes when you're gigging a lot, one of the things is that you're so on it. Like, you have this communication, you know each other. When you're gigging 5 nights a week, you don't even have to look at someone to know where things are going most of the time. Yeah. You get to that point, you know, where you're really road. It just is such an extraordinary place when you're gigging a lot with people. Certainly, again, in blues, where you can have something that shifts gear quite a lot, or isn't going to be metronomic, is going to have a dynamic kind of thing going on. But but just in terms of kind of deciding, Brian suggested kind of recording rehearsals. So we've done a couple of things where like we've got interesting things coming out of a range of recordings that were both deliberate and slightly accidental. And it's like, you know, just trying to say you want it polished, but not too much polish. Polish the bejesus out of it. You actually want to have it have that level of raw. And I think actually, again, it's quite challenging as well, because the whole movement toward digital, obviously, in itself compounds some of that. And I also think it's interesting because people are, you know, the way you're talking about what you grew up listening to.
Yeah.
Like your ears become, I won't say accustomed, but you are primed through life and hearing stuff. You're primed to kind of hear things in a certain way. And if music that is popular music is all very polished, something that's raw becomes sort of a little bit indigestible and a little bit kind of like, what in the name of Jesus are you trying to do? So, but I mean, really good. Like, there's so many brilliant things happening. There's so much good reflection back. I mean, I've been delighted. I've been watching some of the stuff like Clannad and Moya, and those are doing like the 50 years thing. And it's extraordinary that there's such longevity. And then you move through the Irish music scene, and I'm so proud of Imelda and all of the different people. I was really glad to reflect on, for example, this summer on Rory Gallagher on the 25th anniversary of his passing, because he encapsulates, and it's probably getting close to a finish up time, but Rory absolutely encapsulates to me an Irish approach to blues, which is about complete conviction and energy and like balls to the wall. But sensitivity and fluidity. He was just such a brilliant artist on every level, and such a charming guy to, such a nice bloke.
Yeah.
You know, really, really nice fella. And again, having had the fortune to meet him, again, I was brought to just on a last top and tail. I was brought to a gig by older brothers that Rory was doing, and then we used to go every year to the January gigs, and I was pretty young, but I was brought in. I remember after one of those, I was brought with, I think it was Niall or Dermot, I was brought to see Rory after the gig in the hotel. Yeah. I mean, I was standing there completely starstruck, like I didn't say a word. But you'd see the idea of him sitting there after the gig, because it had been a stormer of a gig. And he was, again, it was revealing as a musician's life. He was sitting in a hotel room, but he was on his own, you know. We could talk and Niall and whatever was going on. I wouldn't have had a clue what was happening. But the transaction from being playing to just an absolutely baying audience, absolutely roaring for him.
Yeah.
And then he's back to a hotel room. But then further down the line, we saw him at the gig and we met him. And myself and Brian, we were, you may have read this, I wrote about it. We were playing at the what happened for a short while was the Temple Bar Blues Festival. So we were playing and we were gigging all the time at that time, again, whatever year that was. But we happened to walk in. Brian was hanging some paintings of blues artists in Bloom's Hotel. And at the time, Bloom's was really central to a whole load of music activity. That's where there's a lot of fun stuff kind of going on around Bloom's. So he was bringing in the paintings and someone was sitting at the bar. And then I looked and I thought, Jesus, that's Rory. And so I went over and I said, Rory, how's it going? Because we'd met him again. And he kind of looked up and he's smiling and laughing, looking at me. And I said, Jesus, Rory, it's me, Mary. And he said, yeah, of course it is. He says, I was wondering who'd be coming in. I said, I knew it'd be you coming in, carrying paintings of Sonny Boy Williams and like a little Walter or whatever it was. And you know, he and ends up kind of having a good long chat. He was really quite nervous because he hadn't played in Dublin. So again, a musician's life is difficult. You have your so many brilliant high moments, but there are challenges and there's difficulty. But like, if you reach into yourself and believe in yourself and believe that it isn't a bad thing not to be out front all the time, it is sometimes a good thing, like say, to stand back and to listen back and to think through that it affords us a bit of time to regroup sometimes, which has its own value. And sometimes we don't give ourselves time to think. So it's a good old life, but it's a tough one.
It's a tough one. You got to take the rough with the smooth. And, you know, a journalist once said to Eric Clapton, how does it feel to be the greatest guitar player on earth? And he said, I wouldn't know. He says, maybe you should ask Rory Gallagher.
Exactly. I tell you what, there you go. And I mean, again, you know, the greatest guitar or the greatest drum or the greatest anything, even in itself, is a kind of a term that is because I would kind of like to suggest that you actually have what is great about the idea of people. I didn't have a choice. I went to college. I did psychology and I did my master's and stuff like that. But I didn't have a choice at the time, really, to study music unless it was going to be classical Well, actually, at the time, in fact, it was just classical or music for teaching. And I really didn't want to go down that road. In fact, I didn't take music as a leaving cert subject because I didn't feel the need.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was that the sort of programs that you're able to support young people learning and becoming skilled in, you know, people you've been able to and music has evolved from Ballyfermot Rock School days right through to BIM and right through DI or TU Dublin.
Yeah.
Of the different ways that music now can be facilitated by people actually having the opportunity to spend time exploring and hearing and listening to experience and then also learning discipline. So when I say, for example, the pleasure of and the real privilege to play, for example, with Sarah in particular, it has struck me immediately in terms because she's a graduate and she has studied and worked hard and got her qualification. So basically she knows as a professional, just like any other profession, that there's a certain amount of work to be done, but you do it in a way and you approach it as well as you can. And that's a really positive thing. So now we just have to understand or recognize how can we actually ensure that those learners, those students actually understand that they have more than just performing as an option, but that they can connect other pieces of a career. They can make a connection so they can see within themselves as a performer, perhaps they will be good leaders. Perhaps they're good at project management. Perhaps they're good at actually capturing another way of expressing what music provides. And that's where, for example, I think like what I call career management skills, things like, who else am I?
Yeah.
And it's good to be forced out of your one focus. And who else am I? Because every one of us as human beings have such a range of potential.
Absolutely. As musicians, the transferable skills we have are in so many different areas, you know?
Yeah. And I really, really would finish on that sort of really positive affirmation of that.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, the sort of not to worry, things change and they will come back. And again, I think that it's important to lighten, at least, even if it is sort of like, I can't pinpoint how right now, but I do have belief. And that's one of the things that I'd really encourage everyone to feel is a sense of belief.
Yeah, I totally agree with you 100%. I'm the same. I'm not getting bogged down by all this. I'm just getting on with it because I do believe, and I do believe the tide'll turn. You know, and here's looking to 2021.
Exactly.
It could be the greatest year of our lives.
Exactly. I'm waiting for it. And we're all ready to go.
Yeah, ready and waiting. Just push that button, Mary.
Yeah.
Well, look, it's been great talking to you today.
Thanks.
There's so much stuff we didn't cover, so we might have to do another one again in the future.
I'm telling you. I didn't tell you anything about meeting, playing the Cavern Club or...
No, we've got to do all, but I also want to talk about growing up with your brothers and music and how you got it, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Well, we'll do that the next time. Well, it's nice talking to you where I'm not backstage in the Sugar Club riddled with nerves. No gigs.
Mm-hmm.